नमस्ते। सो कलेक्टेड वर्क्स ऑफ द मदर वॉल्यूम 8 कन्वर्सेशंस क्वेश्चंस एंड आंसर्स 1956। सो दिस एज वी नो दिस अ वेरी स्पेशल फ्रॉम हियर ऑनवर्ड्स द वॉल्यूम्स द कन्वर्सेशंस टेक अ डिफरेंट टर्न बिकॉज 56 इज अ वेरी स्पेशल ईयर एंड वी नो व्हाट हैपेंड ऑन दैट ईयर You know, because mother has told us, 29th February 1956, the supramental manifestation. So why I say we know because the mother has told us is because people asked the mother. And then she gave very interesting replies, which we can read as we go. But when I read the mother, I keep saying people are missing out on this treasure. And how the mother and Sri Aurobindo, though one with regard to the writings, I feel Sri Aurobindo is like the snow-clad mountain peaks. So to listen to what the mountain speaks, you have to climb to the mountains, sit in austere silence, then you'll hear what the mountain is speaking. But the mother is the Ganga flowing from the heart of the mountain. So Ganga comes to us right here. We can bathe in the ghats, we can build a dwelling place around it, we can drink its water, we can lose ourselves in it, we can flow to the sea. So at one level Ganga and mountain, Himalayas are the same. But at another level there is a world of difference. Ganga comes to us, but mountains, you have to go to the mountain. So with Sri Aurobindo's writings, often it seems like that. It seems that, you know, you have to really strain, stretch, climb. You almost ascend while reading the writings. And Sri Aurobindo says that also, that why he has brought things up to a certain level and not brought them still nearer, because we strain our consciousness to reach there. But when we read the mother, it is the mountain coming to us, flowing down to us. With not just the same effect, but with a greater magic in a certain sense. Or if I take another analogy, it is of the flute player, the eternal flute player, playing the flute. So the flute player is Sri Aurobindo. Who is the mother? Some people would say she is the flute. That's how some people say she is a disciple of Sri Aurobindo or an instrument of the manifestation. No. She is the breath of the flute player, without which there would be no flute. And it is this breath which carries the heart of love of the flute player right up to the ears, far and wide. So she is the breath of the flute player, the Shakti, as they say. So there are so many ways we can look at it and rejoice in our heart. So in 1956 we see Wednesday classes, and one of the Wednesdays, as we know, the supramental manifestation took place. So these are Wednesday classes, and 1st January she had given the message, the greatest victories are the least noisy. The advent of the supermind, new consciousness, is not announced by the beating of drums. It's very interesting. When we read this volume, there is a whole class on 29th February, on which day the event has taken place. And then there is the next class. She doesn't speak. You know what has happened? Do you know what marvelous things took place? This is something so amazing about Sri Aurobindo and the mother, that often I feel, sometimes when we read the writings and based on that we draw inferences about them, I feel we limit it, because there is so much more that they have not revealed. So if we try to create an image based on what they have written, then we will be mistaken, because it's only a very limited they have released. As we know in Savitri, when at the end of the whole thing, when Savitri is asked that what is the truth, the power in you, and she says, lying low, she replies that, you know, to feel love and oneness is to live. So the sages marvel at her two luminous words. So this is how, And yet, whatever they have given to us is the Kripa Prashad, as I said, it's Ganges. We can admire it, like some people here itself in the volumes, he says. Well, there are some people who look at Supermind with curiosity. So they have curiosity. So Ganges is flowing past and we have curiosity. What is this Ganga? How does it really redeem your... Is it there? Is it not there? All these kind of things. There are others who bathe in it. They drink the nectar of it. So let's now drink the nectar of it. So there's a beautiful conversation on the very first opening on 4th January. And it's very interesting. In this year, she read mainly from portions from the Synthesis of Yoga and Thoughts and Glimpses, the first part. Now, interesting part is that, you know, here we'll get a hint of how Sri Aurobindo's writings, and for that matter, Mother's writings, I won't use the word interpretation, but how they are revealed and how they are received. So some people believe that one should strictly only read. That's true. But the mind of the receiver is still the human mind. And whether you receive it from X, Y, Z or directly, the mind will play its own mischief. Whereas when we go deep into it, behind what is the experience that he is communicating, then it brings us to the threshold of a wonderful discovery. So the sentence that she reads is from the Synthesis of Yoga. If we are to attempt an integral yoga, it will be as well to start with an idea of the divine that is itself integral. There should be an aspiration in the heart wide enough for a realization without any narrow limits. Not only should we avoid a sectarian religious outlook, but also all one-sided philosophical conceptions which try to shut up the ineffable in a restricting mental formula. This is so liberating, this sentence itself. The first impression with this sentence means liberation. You cannot limit divine to any formula, any dogma, any. Whatever you are experiencing is your experience. You have used a method, a way it came to you like that. But you cannot turn it into a convenient formula for everybody. That's how religions are formed. So, right at the beginning, we have this question which is asked, Sweet Mother, what does Sri Aurobindo mean by an integral idea of the divine? Because we have to have some idea. We can't just divine as someone, something vague. So, what is the idea of the divine? People have different idea of the divine. They have an idea of something which is pure, beautiful, true, highest, absolute. Or they have the idea of divine as a being. They have the idea of divine as judge. They have the idea of divine as all-powerful, all-knowing. There are different ideas of the divine. So the mother says, everyone forms an idea of the divine for himself according to his personal taste, his possibilities of understanding, his mental preferences, and even his desires. People form the idea of the divine they want, the divine they wish to meet. And so naturally they limit their realizations considerably. So often we have this idea in certain religions, divine punishes. That's because our human consciousness likes to punish. We want to punish those whom, according to our conception, has not done good. So we want to see them punished. And when they don't get punished, our divine idea of the divine goes topsy-turvy. So in some religions, when they see divine is not punishing, they go out to punish. Blasphemy. So therefore we will punish. If you really believe divine is the judge, let him do his own bit. No, I will be the instrument to punish. Is their problem. So mother says, by making conceptions which are limited, we limit the divine realization. If I take it that divine is a judge, we'll meet him only as a judge. And it won't be a very pleasant experience for sure. Because if we start judging, we don't know where we will stand. Equally, we can take it as that the divine is infinite grace, infinite love, mercy as we saw. And that immediately broadens us at one level. And then we can take all the aspects of the divine which men have conceived and all that is still beyond. There are interesting things in Indian thought. For instance, there is a concept of the divine as a child. It is there in the Vedas that the Agni is to be treated as a child also. And it's very fascinating. So the meaning that comes from there is that child means because it's the new consciousness. In our mentalized, vital, physical, ego troubled consciousness, suddenly there is this new child. And like a child, we have to adjust ourselves to this new entrant. But I have seen people, when this idea gets translated into the human head, there are devotees. There is a whole path in Vaishnava sect which is called as Pushti Marg, where you worship Krishna as a child. So you take care of the child. You'll get up in the morning, wake him up, then do the snan and everything. Then you will go, because you have to first take care of the child. You can't ask anything from the child. So you see how a profound truth can become very humanized. I'm not saying there's anything wrong. Whatever relation I want to form with the divine, divine is ready to form that relation. But she's saying something very interesting. But if we can come to understand that the divine is all that we can conceive of and infinitely more, we begin to progress towards integrality. Integrality is an extremely difficult thing for the human consciousness, which begins to be conscious only by limiting itself. But still, with a little effort, for those who know how to play with mental activities, it is possible to widen oneself sufficiently to approach something integral. You form an idea of the divine which suits your own nature and your own conception, don't you? So if you want to get out of yourself a little and attempt to do a truly integral yoga, you must try to understand that the divine is not only what you think or feel him to be, but also what others think and feel him to be, and in addition, something that nobody can think and feel. And I find this phrase not only liberating, but including in its scope two different ways of looking at the divine reality in the Vedic lore. One is neti neti. So neti neti is one way to say that no conception of yours. You can't identify the divine with any conception. So there is neti neti, is beyond. So it's somewhat something like what Buddha also would say, you know, that don't limit the divine to any experience. On the other hand, there is iti iti. All this that is the divine. And it's easy to connect, because in the manifestation we can say, for instance, everything of preeminence, everything that is predominantly beautiful, everything that carries within it the music of truth, is divine. In the manifestation, we can, all that highest I aspire for is divine. We can put it like that, iti iti, in the manifestation. Ordinarily, it is done like that. But she says, all that is, you can say, at the same time, he also exceeds. So both together. So see how she resolves this antagonism, that why you want to limit him either to not this, not this, or even to this is and this is. He can be both at once. So first she immediately widens her mind. And there is a meaning, because what he is not today, neti neti, is not come into any mental conception, any manifestation. He may enter into the manifestation tomorrow. So this is the beauty of this. So she says, if you understand this, you have taken the first step on the path of integrality. And then she says something very interesting. That people often say, oh, this is divine, this is not divine. Whatever I do, good is divine. Whatever others do is not divine. What do they know about it? And then there are those who have not yet set foot on the path, who come here and see things or people and tell you. You know what they tell. This ashram has nothing to do with the divine. It is not at all divine. But if you ask them what is divine, they would be hard put to it to answer. Why? People often ask, people, they want to see some activity, like where is some collective prayer going on? Where is some dhol manjira going on? Some people ask, where is satsang going on? Now if you say that there is a talk at Matri Sadhan, no, they want satsang in the classical mode. Somebody should come sit on some takat, wear some mala, and start doing satsang. He should pick up a phrase, of from one of the sacred scriptures, somebody should see. This is your idea, conception. So look at mother, this is the highest satsang. Mother herself speaking. But see, it's not fitting into any standard format. So they are looking for, or they want to see, when they see somebody sitting in meditation, he's a realized person. I've seen this, people coming and asking. Asking me names. Who is this person? I said, why? I see him sitting in meditation for long. So I have to tell them it won't be very long that he will keep sitting in meditation. It happened like that. So, you know, this our conception that somebody is sitting, and if he is sitting very straight, if he is sitting without support of the pillar, people get impressed. They look there. Immediately they look there. Or if somebody is reading a book, it's good. Nothing wrong with any of this. But to identify the divine or divine movement with any of these activities, that is a problem. So she is widening us. All these are good. It's not that this is not good. But this idea, so people don't know what is divine. So people look for people who are meditating, who are in a particular dress, who are walking without a smile. They are looking for such a person, Babaji. Basically, they are not looking for divine, they are looking for their Babaji. But there is no Babaji. So there is a problem. So she says, and the less one knows, the more one judges. That's an absolute fact. The more one knows, the less one can pronounce judgment on things. How beautiful. So she continues and says, and there is a moment when one should be unable to say, one would be unable to say, this is divine and that is not divine. For a time comes when one sees the whole universe in so total and comprehensive a way that to tell the truth, it is indispensable to take away anything from it without disturbing everything. So that's where she is taking us. That these distinctions that we draw based on conceptions. But she says it's a progressive. But then see how beautifully. So when we look at it purely as a mental conception, okay, this is how, this is divine, this is not divine. But then there is the other part, and that other part is that then how do I act? She understands that if I say all is divine, then immediately there is a problem. So she resolves this dilemma also. So she says, so that you know we don't use this profound, vast truth to say everything that I do is divine. So she says, now if one comes down again from this consciousness to a more external consciousness, naturally, one begins to feel very precisely the things which help one to reach the true consciousness and those which bar the way or pull one back or even struggle against the progress. And so the outlook changes. And one has to say, this is divine or this helps me toward the divine and that is against the divine. It is the enemy of the divine. So for each one of us, we have to see. Again, we can't make a standard format rule for everyone. So in terms of action, because action involves a choice. You can't say that I'll act indiscriminately because all is God. Yes, but in manifestation it is progressing. And each one is progressing from one step to another, to a third step. So for each one it has to be different. But this is a pragmatic point of view for action. Because one has not yet reached the consciousness which goes beyond all that. Because one has not attained that inner perfection. So how is the choice made when one has attained the inner perfection? It's not based on any mental concept. It's based on the spontaneous inspiration or the upsurging of truth. So we see this, we see in Mother's actions. How Amal Kiran is standing with his one foot on ground, another foot on the car, Mother's car. On the bonnet, what a style it must be. And the mother gave him good. What happened, mother? You can't be unconscious on the battlefield. There are her words. So, in action, you have to make a choice. So she reminds. And the surest means to discernment is a conscious and willing surrender as complete as possible to to the divine will and guidance. So how are we going to arrive at that state to know what should be done and not done? So if you surrender your individual will to the divine will, not that I'll not will. So when we say that all is the divine, whatever I do, then we are not willing. So we have lent our will to all kinds of forces. But a conscious and willing surrender, that well, I'll surrender my will to the divine, then the guidance comes. You want to do what the divine wants you to do. It's very different from, I'll do anything, any whatever, because it's all the all divine. So it's a very beautiful Then there is another very interesting thing she says. Again, we have this all is same. So all is same, so everybody divine has chosen. So is there a difference or not? So there is a statement of there is something from Sri Aurobindo on which somebody has asked, Mother, what does a powerful yoga mean? I remember this long back when I had read this, it has hit me also very hard. What is powerful yoga? Do you have to great intensity? What is meant by powerful yoga? A powerful yoga, you don't know what powerful means? But here Sri Aurobindo says, this intellectual preparation can indeed be the first stage in a powerful yoga. But it's not indispensable. Now you see there are people who say it's not required. You don't need to read books, you don't need to do, you just, it's enough that you love the mother, it's enough that you serve her. So he says, yes, it's not indispensable that you have to read. But this may be indispensable if you are going to engage in a powerful yoga. So she is asked that what is powerful yoga? So the mother says, yes, a powerful yoga is a very complete yoga, which contains many things, takes in many elements. So this element of intellectual knowledge makes the yoga more powerful. All the things which ordinarily we shun, that I don't want to take it. That's why mother says, if you have more difficulties, ultimately the realization is more complete, more perfect. So it takes in all kinds of elements. Even with regard to the ashram, the mother says that when children came, because of the Second World War, she says it was a little premature. The Second World War left a little package at our doorstep. And then she uses the word little sprouts, children. It changed the ashram life completely. Imagine everybody is serious, meditating, whatever. Suddenly these children are running around doing ringa ringa roses. You can't, you don't know how to deal with them. This is actually documented. People didn't know how to deal with them. Till then ashram life was very different. There are children who sat in Champaklalji's lap and they were pulling his beard. Can you imagine? Somebody told me, who was a child here studying there, says once he put a chewing gum in the beard. And did all this. Now you don't know how to deal with this. And though the mother says that, it's much more divine to be with children. And about Nalnida people say that otherwise he would be normally very curt. Not just serious, very curt. If you knock at his door and he opens the door, he suddenly sees, he may get into that, ki chai, what do you want? And he would sense, what is it, some nonsense, some something. He would shut the door. Now it may look very rude. But when children came, he would always invariably, they were welcome, they could sit, they could do. So this is how this understanding. So what is this? Is it the same as the integral yoga? Mother says, not quite. An integral yoga is one which comprises all the parts of the being and all the activities of the being. But the activities of one being are not as powerful as the activities of another. And the integrality of one being is not as total as the integrality of another. It's the same thing that, a poor man gives everything of his to the divine. And if a rich man gives everything of his, now there is a difference, whether you like it or not, in terms of the usefulness to the divine. So she gives that example later on also. And basically integral is that each one engages with all the parts of one's consciousness as it is. And a powerful yoga is where you develop. You don't want to leave anything undeveloped. My mind as it is developed, I participate. But I develop the mind in its many sides. And then I had a cat which was doing yoga. She gives an example. Well, the yoga of the cat could not be as powerful as the yoga of man. And yet, it was as integral, it was quite complete. Even its body took part in its yoga, but its way of doing it naturally was not human. So yes, she explains very beautifully that things can be complete, but things can develop. It's like you offer a bud to the divine. Well, bud is bud. At that stage, whatever it is offered. But a bud which is develops into a fully blossomed flower and then you offer, there is a difference. So the same thing she speaks of here. And this is a very sweet story. Shobindu says, give all you have and all you are. Mother says. And then she says this story. She says, this does not depend upon the amount of wealth. I remember having read in a book of Indian legends a story like this. There was a very poor, very old woman who had nothing, who was quite destitute, who lived in a miserable little hut, and who had been given a fruit. It was a mango. She had eaten half of it and kept the other half for the next day. Because it was something so marvelous that one did not often happen to get it. A mango. And then when night fell, someone knocked at the rickety door and asked for hospitality. And this someone came in and told her he wanted shelter and was hungry. So she said to him, well, I have no fire to warm you. I have no blanket to cover you. And I have half a mango left. That is all I have. If you want it, I have eaten half of it. And it turned out that this someone was Shiva and that she was filled with an inner glory. For she had made a perfect gift of herself and all she had. I read that. I found it magnificent. The rich man or even people who are quite well off and have all sorts of things in life and give to the divine what they have in surplus. For usually the gesture, this is the gesture, one has a little more money than one needs, one has a few more things than one needs. And so generously one gives that to the divine. It is better than giving nothing. But even if this little more than what they need represents lakhs of rupees, the gift is less perfect than the one half of the mango. But at the same time she says that nevertheless it is more useful. So we have to see both sides of the story. This reminded me of one of my interaction with someone. Normally when we offer food, many of us, we close our eyes and then we pray. Some people pray with folded hands. Some say mantra. In childhood we have learned that take a little water and put it around the plate and then pray at a particular mantra. So one of the things that had struck me when I came here with a particular sadhak was that he would not do any of these things. Food is there and he starts eating. So I was a bit, that what something is there which I am missing. And he got my thought. So he said, actually, you can offer before you eat or you can offer every morsel. I said, yes, I hear. Since then, that's the thing I thought, that inwardly that's the state that you are offering everything. Well, of course, you may forget initially, but slowly it becomes your state. And one thing I remember which people have told me, I have not seen, is with Babaji Maharaj, that he would, with his hand he would eat, so mix the food, take quite some time as if he's mixing again and again, and then he will put it in his mouth. I have a feeling, I don't know about this, that probably he was doing this. So this is one way to remember so that you don't forget. So if you eat very fast, you're likely to forget. So, yeah, of course, we know this, that this place is for people who like progress. Not for those who come and say, oh, I have worked hard in my life, now I want to rest. Will you please give me a place in the ashram? I tell them, not here. This is not a place for rest because you have worked hard. This is a place for working even harder than before. This is so true. Often people ask me, I say, compared to this Air Force was outwardly, I am saying, this is a delight, sheer delight. But if you see in terms of number of hours, it is much more simple. And after that, you are free to do whatever you want to. Here, you are not free to do whatever you want to. There is a great freedom, but you are constantly, you know, because this is not a yoga which stops. It's whether you like it or not, it's a 24/7 thing going on. So, she says, go there. You will enter into meditation and you will get rest. Now it is not possible, so I send them to the Himalaya. I tell them, go and sit before the eternal snows. That will do you good. So this is not yoga. Of course, meditation is there, but you know, for hours we are sitting in meditation. Again, for some person it may be necessary. And the mother may herself advise this. But in general, to, you know, this takes the entire totality of a being. And to remain conscious all the time, this is a big challenge. And then she says, there are two sides of the work. This, the aspect of this yoga, which is most often not understood. Aspiration, everybody understands. Surrender, everybody understands. The moment you say rejection, they say, then it's like traditional yoga, you are shunning the world. No, you are not shunning the world. You are engaging with the world in a much more powerful and beautiful way. So what is being rejected is our viruses which have come and through which we are engaging with the world. And so she says there is the positive side of the work, which is to increase one's aspiration. This is, of course, more important. Shobhindra and the mother both have said that this should be the mainstay. 75% should be stress on this. Develop one's consciousness, unify one's being, to go within in order to enter more and more into contact with one's psychic being. To take up all the parts, all the movements, all the activities of one's being and put them before this psychic consciousness so that they fall into their true place in relation to the center. Finally, to organize all one's aspiration towards the divine and one's progress towards the divine. That is the positive side. So what is left is, as at the same time the negative side consists in refusing methodically and with discernment all the influences which come from outside or from the subconscious or inconscient or from the environment and stand in the way of spiritual progress. So these includes influences, suggestions, impulses, and systematically refuse them without ever getting discouraged by their presence, persistence, and ever yielding to their will. One must at the same time observe clearly in one's being all its different elements, obscure, egoistic, unconscious, or even ill-willed, which consciously or otherwise answer these bad influences. So this is the negative side. So negative side, why it is important? Because otherwise, he says, they cancel each other. You are aspiring and you are having a beautiful aspiration, but at the same time, you are also inviting all that is hostile to the divine, negative influences. So you are making the body and mind a battlefield. It makes things very complicated then. And also it's like inviting, if we invite the divine to our house, how we will keep the house? We'll keep it clean. We'll try to keep it organized. So it's something like that, that the inner house in which we are inviting the divine, we should cleanse it. It's a long process. That's why she says you have to persist. You should not be get disappointed or dejected because of their persistence. Otherwise, all progress made on one side is set off by an attack of the adverse forces on the other. So the more you advance, the more vigilant you become. And then she gives a very interesting advice. And the most essential quality is perseverance, endurance, and this is interesting. And what shall I call it? A kind of inner good humor, which helps you not to get discouraged. So this way, cheerfulness, as Niruddha's letters we'll see. He say, oh, I fell again. And then he's lamenting. He says, if you have fallen, don't lament. Brush your pants, walk again. Don't start lamenting, complaining. Get up and walk again. This is what the yoga is about. Every little inch you advance, some days you will go very fast, someday it will be very slow, someday you are just holding out to a position. Some days you seem to be taking one step backward. Now, don't mentally don't give up. Go back two steps forward. This is how the yoga advances, because depending on which part is touched, that's how the advance takes place. So the good humor. She explains very interestingly about hierarchy. Now comes a very interesting conversation, which is about how these qualities are interconnected. So mother used to give name to flowers, we all know. So there is a flower to which she has named as the champak flower. She has named psychological perfection. And then there is another which is golden champa. She has named it supramental psychological perfection. When all, each of these qualities rises to its utmost, and then they become, they arrive at their supramental change. So, it's very interesting. Supramental psychological perfection, incidentally, it is a very, very wonderful fragrance to start with. And color, which is like, it's golden, but it's not golden. It's very, very interesting flower. So, what are these qualities of these? This flower has 5 petals. So she says, what are these qualities? Aspiration, devotion, sincerity, faith and surrender. These are the things that we need. And then she explains very interestingly that people often say that I have faith in God. And then they put a but. There's always a but. I want the divine, but. I want to be sincere, but. So she puts it very beautifully. She says you need to have, first she explains sincerity. She says sincerity is transparency. That means when we stand before the divine, she gives an example that there are people, when I look into their eyes, I can go deep inside. Nothing they hide from the divine. They are not trying to project an image. But there are others, you feel that there is an iron wall. You can't go deeper. And this I have seen in human consciousness. We can see in ourselves when we are insincere, your eyes will change and your face will change. It's an indication. And same thing I have seen with children. Suddenly, it's very interesting that there are people, you know, they will start avoiding your gaze. So this avoidance of gaze is itself a sign that there is a play of falsehood. In Hindi, actually, you say it also. Aak chura rahe ho. Why you are trying to conceal something? Why we try to conceal something by taking away the eyes? Because the eyes are mirrors. They will, of course, it's used in a romantic songs also that, you know, aak churana. Kyunki your feelings will be revealed. Eyes are like that. But actually, it is so, so true. Eyes are like mirrors of the soul. But there are some people who are so experts in hiding. But if you really look into the eyes, you will feel you just can't go anywhere. These eyes are just like, almost like glass. And that is something you'll see, the difference between animal eyes and human eyes. Animal eyes, especially at night, if you shine a torch, like a glass. Individual soul is not there. But in human beings, you will see. And even in children, you'll see directly. You know, these eyes are just like, can go to any depth. But when we tell lies, when we are, you know, engaged in falsehood, slowly the eyes begin to change. It's one of the changes which is, you know, you don't have to go for big tests. If your eyes are clear, that means things are clear. If you can smile, you are fine. So, doctors will not agree. It's okay. So, you have to go through a battery of tests, you know. So, this is, she speaks of the sincerity as the first quality. Then she says, another which is important is to have faith. So, here she says that you may very easily remain under the impression that you have faith and yet be losing all trust in the divine power or divine goodness. And she speaks of 3 stumbling blocks. First is, where you say, I have faith in the divine and the divine is doing everything, who can do everything, all that happens in me, in others, everywhere is the work of the divine and the divine alone. This is a very dangerous proposition. Well, if you do that, basically you are using faith to justify your laziness. And you are passing everything on the divine. So in the end, you end up losing faith. Because deep inside, you have certain wishes and wants. When you see things are not happening according to that, or according to our conception, then we end up saying that they will blame the divine for all the most terrible wrongs. So this is very important, because often we hear, when mother will call, I will come. Mother will call means now you have turned, you have already have the call, what you want, some letter, telegram maybe, please come, mother is desperately needs you, divine cannot work, cannot be done unless you come. Here nobody bothers, which is very good. You have put in your place. First, learn to be nobody and nothing. Outside you are somebody or something. If nowhere else in your family. Here even in your family you are. Mother, make sure that you become nobody and nothing. That annul thyself, that God may be all. So this idea that somebody will call me, who are we? If I feel that this is it, I should rush. So this is where she reminds us. Then there is another kind who say they have faith but tell themselves, well, I have faith in the divine, but this world, I see quite well what it's like. First of all, I suffer so much, don't I? I'm very unhappy, far more unhappy than all my neighbors. And mother's touch of humor, she says, for one is always far more unhappy than all one's neighbors. It's so wonderful. I am very unhappy and truly life is cruel to me. But then the divine is divine. He must be powerless, otherwise being so good, how could he let me suffer so much? But I have faith. So this ends up like that. It's a person who keeps, right, I have faith. I have kept my faith, but this not happening, that not happening, even so outer life. Why? What is your faith? What do you want really from the divine? What is your aspiration? Keep moving toward that aspiration. Who is stopping you to move toward that? That aspiration is completely dependent of all the events and situations of your life. And then the third stumbling block, she says, there are people who have what may be called a warped and excessive modesty or humility and who tell themselves. This is very funny. Surely the divine has thrown me out. I am good for nothing. He can do nothing with me. The only thing for me is to give up the game. For he finds me unworthy of him. Lo. This is too much. So these are the three stumbling blocks of faith. What is faith? Faith by its nature is something which knows that the divine is there. So therefore you are always happy. Even in situations which apparently somebody would say, oh my God, still you will be happy. Even if you are besieged by all kinds of illnesses, you are not going to say, I have faith, but see, maybe the divine has hit me hard. Maybe he is trying to teach me a lesson. Maybe, you know, this, maybe that. You have faith, and with that faith you continue to move, continue to steadily aspire. So, unless one adds to faith a total and complete trust in the divine grace, there will be difficulties. So then comes devotion, your surrender and trust. Then she says, you have devotion and you keep your ego. And then your ego makes you do all sorts of things out of devotion. Things which are terribly egoistic. So we know that how people become so egocentric sometimes, and all in the name of God and love for God, because their devotion in that they do things. And she gives very interesting examples. And so when you find out the divine for some reason does not answer to your devotion with the enthusiasm you expected of him, you despair and fall back into the same three difficulties, that the divine is cruel, because you believe, see, what is egoistic devotion? That you are devoted. So you may believe, for example, that every day morning, 3 o'clock, you are getting up. And you are going to the ashram and doing sweeping. I have actually seen this in these instances. So there comes this feeling that I am doing this. this devotion. Of course it is devotion and service, nobody can deny. But see how the ego comes in. Egoistic devotion. And I have even heard people say things like that. Oh, you know, he is great sadhak. So what is the criteria? Morning 4 o'clock he comes, takes the broom and sweeps the door. It's good, very good. But the moment you think I am getting up in the morning and doing this, you have lost it. So there is a show of devotion, there is an egoistic devotion. And then when something happens, because you are holding that devotion very egoistically, then you begin to doubt that why the divine has not done. He is very cruel. I am so devoted and yet this is what he does. He is no longer as gentle and near to them as before. He has withdrawn. And then we have things like, why hast thou deserted me? Thou hast abandoned me. Oh monster, they don't dare to say this. But think it. Or else they say, oh, I must have made such a serious mistake that I am thrown out. Means people don't know how to chill, basically. They go into despair. Everything, divine has judged you, your devotion, because you have put yourself in a slot. Divine didn't say that you are the most devoted person. Actually, he doesn't do like that. Nobody is comparing anyone with anyone. But you have put yourself in that slot that I am the most devoted. So when something, it's like, is this word that there is already enough problem in life, okay? But we create a lot many more problem by our mental conception. This I have seen constantly in life. That lot of problem. There was no problem, but we have looked at life so differently that has created problem. For instance, people come to ashram and they start seeing who is doing what and this person, that complaint, this arrangement, that somebody occupying this chair, this table chair given to me, not given to me, somebody else is given. Now, these never were a problem. If you really look at it, they never were a problem. Why did you come? So, I ask, why have you come? Now, you don't have an answer. That's why aspiration will come. If you have come to unite with the mother or to serve her, then none of this is important. Now, none of these was important. But they become important. Why? Because the mind has put them, given them an importance. So if you are devoted, what you want? Nearness with the divine. And what nearness you want? Inner nearness with the divine. As simple as that. So this is where she says that people begin to. So she says, what should always accompany devotion? The sense of gratitude that the divine exists. Why we should be grateful? Really, I mean, sometimes when you look at it, she exists, she has called us to the path, and she is carrying us, my God, what more one can ever imagine or need or want. I mean, there should be no complaint after that. Because imagine, out of trillions or billions of people, you know, at least she has put that faith in you. Then she has shown a path. She has given the aspiration. She is making us walk the path. What more do we expect? She is giving the assurance that one day you will arrive. So gratitude that the divine exists, that feeling of a marveling thankfulness which truly fills you with a sublime joy at the fact that the divine exists. That there is something in the universe which is the divine. That it is not just the monstrosity we see. And each time that the least thing puts you either directly or indirectly in contact with him, the heart is filled with so intense, so marvelous a joy. Such a gratitude as of all things has the most delightful taste. And this can come at any moment. You go somewhere, you are traveling. Suddenly you look at something which is like mother's symbol or something which is reminder, and your heart is so, oh, this is kind of connection. That's all. Not that sadhana is an inner process. So these things, smallest of things that feel you. Sometimes you're looking at a flower bloom. Sometimes the morning sunrise. All this can fill our heart with thankfulness. The divine exists and the fact that I have another day to. Every day, every moment is like we are having an opportunity to increase our score. So yesterday if I had remembered so many times, forgotten so many times, doesn't matter. Today I can increase, I can remember more. So all this fills the heart with gratitude. And then she says something very nice. There is nothing which gives you a joy equal to that of gratitude. And she says gratitude is just a slightly different form of love. and upon earth it is the material expression of the divine. The divine presence, it's a material expression. How to know that if somebody is in contact with the divine or not? People are looking for vision, experiences. Oh, you know, he saw that. Duryodhan also saw Sri Krishna in a form which actually people would covet. That's not the point. If your heart is full of gratitude, thankfulness, it's a sign that you are in contact with the divine. If you have humility, it's a sign that you are in contact with the divine. Because automatically it gives that humility. Because you are in the presence of that infinity. So, she says something very beautiful. One is gratitude. Why? People ask, why should I be thankful? Divine exists. So because of divine there is hope. Then see how marvelous. One hears a bird sing. So see the manifestations. One hears a bird sing. Sees a lovely flower. Looks at a little child. All that is a meditation actually. Shubhendu describes this in Ishavasyupanishad. Look yonder, look at this old man crouching and walking. Do you see the divine? Look at this girl who is smiling. Do you see the divine? Look at this child laughing. That's what we see in who? Do you see the divine? Look at the star. Do you see the divine? Look at the flower. Do you see the divine? So it can be a constantly ongoing meditation. And there's so much of it all the time. Then she says, observes an act of generosity. It fills the heart with joy that somebody has that inner generosity. Reads a beautiful sentence. Looks at the setting sun. No matter what, suddenly this comes upon you. This kind of emotion. Indeed, so deep, so intense that the world manifests the divine. That there is something behind the world which is the divine. It's so beautiful. It's a meditation actually. And it means that instead of shutting our eyes to the world and meditating, open the eyes and meditate. Then we'll see so much of divine presence everywhere in everything. These are the divine manifestations. As Shubhendu says in one of his writings in the Upanishad, that the divine is absolute beyond anything. Parabrahman. He says, so you can't know. You can become one, but you can't know. She says, so how do you know the divine? He says, you can know him through the manifestations. That is where Sri Krishna, even in Vibhuti Yoga, he explains. They are his manifestations. And even in the mother, he says, they are limited, so more seizable by the human consciousness. So the fact that, you know, the divine manifests and all is his glory, it can fill the heart with joy. And finally, she speaks about this courage, which is, she says, is aspiration. So what is the sign of aspiration? She says, if you have these thoughts, she says, you throw yourself into the adventure without looking back and without asking for a single minute, what's going to happen? For if you ask what is going to happen, you never start. You always remain stuck there, rooted to the spot. Afraid to lose something, to lose your balance. That's why I speak of courage, but really it is aspiration. They go together. A real aspiration is something full of courage. It's agni, no? It makes you go forward, doesn't matter. And now, surrender. In English, the word is surrender. And this he speaks about self-giving. So, sincerity or transparency, faith or trust, devotion or gratitude, courage or aspiration, endurance or perseverance. This is the last one, and she says, perseverance itself is a sign of surrender. Because you persevere, because you know. Somewhere it is also a sign of faith. It's a sign of aspiration. So one perseveres, perseveres, perseveres. One never gives up. Why? Because the divine exists. So this is, then there is something very, interesting. Of course, he reminds us that theory of the Gita is not the whole truth. On 29th February, she closes the conversation by saying, it is divine in the inconscient who aspires for the divine. And just after that, we see that the supramental manifestation takes place. Then there is a, people always are looking for methods. So there is something which he says is dynamic meditation. This term she has used, Shrivindra has used, he has used the word, Shrivindra has used the word self-dynamizing meditation. So what is this meditation? She says it is a meditation that has the power of transforming your being. It is a meditation which makes you progress. As opposed to static meditation, which is immobile and relatively inert, and which changes nothing in your consciousness or in your way of being, a dynamic meditation is a meditation of transformation. So once she has explained that you concentrate, gather all the energies, that's the first thing before meditation. Every time, she says, you have to gather your energies, concentrate on the solar plexus in the heart center. Of course, you can do it in different ways, but basically, the basic essence. Then begins the meditation. Without it, there is no meditation actually. It's difficult. Then from there, you can concentrate on the object, the divine. So this is one kind of meditation. You concentrate on the Divine Mother. And you follow that movement, whatever she is. And the other is where after gathering the consciousness, you just open. In a state of giving oneself. This is the second. But this one which she is describing is a third one. Self-dynamizing meditation. So here she says, generally people don't have a dynamic meditation when they enter into meditation, or at least what they call meditation. They enter into a kind of immobility where nothing stirs, and they come out of it exactly as they went in, without any change, either in their being or in their consciousness. And the more motionless it is, the happier they are. They could meditate in this way for eternities. It would never change anything, either in the universe or in themselves. So she speaks of the self-dynamizing meditation, which is a transforming meditation. So she is asked that, is it done in a different way? She says, no, it's not about different way. What is important is the aspiration, why one meditates. So she says, I think the most important thing is to know why one meditates. And this is what gives the quality of the meditation and makes it of one order or another. You may meditate to open yourself to the divine force. You may meditate to reject the ordinary consciousness. You may meditate to enter the depths of your being. You may meditate to learn how to give yourself integrally. You may meditate for all kinds of things. You may meditate to enter into peace and calm and silence. But you may also meditate to receive the force of transformation, to discover the points to be transformed, to trace out the line of progress. And then you may also meditate for very practical reasons, when you have a difficulty to clear up, a solution to find. When you want help in some action or other, you may meditate for that too. I think everyone has his own mode of meditation. But if one wants the meditation to be dynamic, one must have an aspiration for progress. So basically, and this progress may take many forms. This progress may be that some part of nature, when we want to reject something. And we can use images, doesn't matter. You can use images, sort of mother cleansing everything. Or simply, you know, a peace which is entering inside and all the restless parts are becoming more and more quiet and peaceful. Or a strength. Or just the urge to give oneself more and more. To grow in sincerity. Anything. So basically it is meditation with aspiration. Not just sitting quietly. And then one enters into immobility. One enters into trance. And if one is sensible, one doesn't disturb others with the snoring. So that's the only... You know, otherwise you're sitting, you come out of it, you feel peaceful. It's a very feel-good thing. And you people do enter into sometimes very beautiful states also. But that doesn't change. You may have an experience, it doesn't change you. To change, it has to be dynamic. That's what she is reminding us. Yes, we can close with this because this was the year of supramental manifestation. So this, it is here that we see a very interesting, first time she is being asked the because she had declared it only in April that the supramental manifestation has taken place. So we see that in May, 24th April, she had given the message. Before that, nobody knew. So as soon as people came to know, you know, lightning speed word manifest. Utar gaya, Bhagwan aa gaya, supra. Now, you know, people took trains and came immediately. They were expecting. This is 2nd May, this conversation. So 24th April, 1st May. Some people suddenly came. Oh, you know, word spreads. Ho gaya, ho gaya, ho gaya. Supramental has come. Now people have their own way of, you know, explaining. So people took train and came. And they are asking. First they start asking, where is the new race? Aapne toh bola tha, you had said new race will come. Now supermind has come. So where is the new race? Mother says, the new race? Wait for something like a few thousand years. And you will see it. Now these people got very disheartened because they were thinking magic. So, when the mind descended upon earth, between the time the mind manifested in the earth atmosphere and the time the first man appeared, nearly a million years elapsed. Now it will go faster because man expects it. He has a vague idea. Basically it means faster means a few thousand years. At another place he says maybe 1,000 years. But still, people want it instantly. Maggie noodle after all. Divine should behave like that. But faster means still thousands of years probably. Then she says with a sense of humor, we shall speak about it again after a few thousand years. Now, people who are inwardly ready, who are open and in contact with higher forces, people who have had a more or less direct personal contact with the supramental light and consciousness are able to feel the difference in the earth atmosphere. But the point is, much will happen. New race means the transformed physical. That's what it means. But so much will happen and is happening. But people who are stuck where I want to see that first supramental body. Okay, even if you see, it won't help you. It's not your body. You can't snatch it away. Much will happen inside, which is happening, the psychic realization, which is so wonderful, the spiritual changes which take place, spiritual opening, and even the touches of the supramental, the whole change of consciousness within, getting supramentalized, so beautiful. So, she says, how will people notice it? They don't notice the constant miracle of the intervention of forces which changes circumstances and characters and has a very widespread result. This they do not call a miracle. For only the mere appearance is seen and this seems quite natural. But truly speaking, if you were to reflect upon the least little thing that happens, you would be obliged to acknowledge that it is miraculous. But doctors take the credit. That's a different story altogether. But many things, one linked to another, it's so amazing when we begin to see this. But most important miracle that is happening, she says, is the change of character that happens inside you. And this is a process which goes on. This is something so amazing because of the intervention of the forces. But I have my simple take on it. The other day somebody was saying, doctor, all the time I used to pray to mother, miracle would happen. Literally, 17 times, even counted, instantly. But always. Then one particular problem, I have been constantly asking, 17 times I have prayed, but the miracle haven't happened. I said, because a greater miracle has happened. What is it? I said, because the mother is telling you, from the miracle, remove the CLE. So what is it? I said, Mira. And up till now, Mira is only for miracle doer. Now mother is saying, how about me? Do you love me or you want me? So you see, this miracle, change it to Mira, forget about all else. So this change that takes place, so people come and ask, how are we going to profit from it? Many people have come here and are asking, 2nd May, kya dekho train leke, I don't know from where. Mother says, and why should they profit from it? What are their claims to profit? Just because they have taken a train to come here? I knew some people who came here quite a long, long time ago, something like, oh, I don't remember now, but very long ago, some 20 years. And the first time someone died in the ashram, they showed considerable dissatisfaction, saying, but I came here because I thought this yoga would make me immortal. But if people can die, why should I have come? Kamal. I mean, poor divine, sometimes you feel so sad about. Nobody loves him for what he is, huh? Everybody wants to love him for what he can give me. And nobody wants to give himself. That's what she says. So the disciple is also not going to give up. Huh? They ask if it will be easier to overcome their inner difficulties. I shall repeat the same thing. What grounds and what right have they to ask that it should be easier? Why should it be easier? To satisfy people's laziness and indolence. See, Mahakali suddenly, yeah, what is a love? And then the person asks, give up nahi kar raha hai. Because when something new happens, people always have the idea of profiting from him. Again that word. Mother. No, not only when there is something new, everywhere and always people have the idea of profiting. But that is indeed the best way of not getting anything. Whom do they want to deceive here? The divine? That is hardly possible. So she says that when they come, they want all her time. And if she doesn't give time, they start complaining. She says, we have 1800 people already. Even if I was to give 1 minute to everyone, I can't manage. She says, it's just not possible. But people don't understand. So they want the profit. Benefit. So the disciple asks again, Kuma firake, huh? Mother, when mind descended into the earth atmosphere, the apes had not made any effort to change into man, had they? It was nature which provided the effort. But here he is wanting to say, like apes, you change us. Basically, he is now coming back to that. There she says, but it is not man who is going to change himself into Superman. See, she is also playing with the disciple. So he says, no. So she says, just try changing yourself. Then she says, only, yes, there is an only. I don't want to be so cruel. Now man can collaborate. Man can collaborate. That is to say, he can lend himself to the process with goodwill, with aspiration, and help as best as he can. So what is the difference? It means now there is the possibility of transformation. Will it happen automatically? Well, at some point ultimately, yes. When the blind will see, people will ill will, but that's much, much long. Right now, by aspiration, by giving us through surrender, all the things he has spoken about, we can collaborate. So that's what collaboration means. And that is why I said, it would go faster. Hopefully much faster. But even so, much faster is still going to take a little time. And then she says that, well, I am not speaking of people from outside, even in ashram. Why none of you could experience that something has happened on 29th February. She speaks of that. And then she makes the distinction between descent, ascent and manifestation. So she says ascent is an individual phenomena and descent is an individual phenomena. There are some people who try to come in touch with the supermind. It's a very rare thing. Let's not start saying ascent hota hai, descent hota hai as a way of life. She says some people, very rare people who try to make an ascent, it's called an ascension because the whole consciousness changes. And then they come in contact with the supermind and then they try to bring that thing here into life. This is an individual. But since when the thing happens at a very massive scale, it's like when you open a tap in your house, water comes. It is descent. And when the rains come, it is manifestation. Rains are now available for everybody. So she says what happened on 29th February. And with that we'll stop. What I call as a descent is in the individual consciousness, just as one speaks of ascent. There is no ascent. You see, there is neither above nor below nor any direction. It is a way of speaking. You speak of ascent when you have the feeling of rising up towards something. And you call it a descent when, after having caught that thing, you bring it down into yourself. But, and that's what happened on 29th February, when the gates are open and the flood comes in, you can't call it a descent. It is a force which is spreading out. Understood? It's all one to me, the words you use. I am not particularly attached to words, but I explain them to you. Now, to people who ask you these insidious questions, now she is finally answering. What we are seeing, what we will see, how we will benefit, what we will profit. At one place he even says that probably they will get some blows to become sincere. So again, disciple is shaken. So at the end she says, you may reply. So when people ask, you may reply that the best way of receiving anything, whatever, is not to pull but to give. So you want to know how the supermind, how you will benefit from it, then lose the idea of benefiting and profiting. Give yourself. If they want to give themselves to the new life, well, the new life will enter into them. As simple as that. But if they want to pull the new life down into themselves, in bracket we can put with the idea of benefiting and profiting, they will close their door with their own egoism. That's all. We'll stop here. Thank you. Jai Mahabhagavan.